This is Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, American sports and black athletes, part two, the revolt of the black athletes. Tonight's guest, Look Magazine sports writer Dick Schaap. You speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Collect Night Call's national phone number, area code 212-749-3311, or in the New York area, 866-5010. Night Call's host in New York City is Del Shields.
Good evening. We continue with our week-long examination of American sports and black athletes. In the current issue of Look magazine, Dick Schaap has written a piece called The Revolt of the Black Athletes, and it begins this way, and we quote, "The wealthy middle-aged white woman stood by the fairway and watched the professional golfers march past her. She talked about a wedding she had hosted in her home for one of the touring pros, and she mentioned casually that Charles Sifford, one of the few Negroes on the golf tour, had been among the guests. I was so glad I invited him, she said. He was so nice. He just sat in the corner and didn't talk to anyone." Unquote. The veteran National Football League backfield star, a white southerner, leaned against the bar and stared out at the dance floor. Several of his Negro teammates celebrating a key victory were dancing with white girls. "Dancing with niggers," he said, shaking his head, "it makes me sick." The American League pitcher briefly considered the views of his fellow whites toward blacks in baseball. "They're still called black you-know-whats when there's none of them in the dugout, and when they're all out on the field, which is where they usually are." Dick Schaap says that all three stories are first-hand reports, and that all three comments honestly reflect prevailing white attitudes in sports. Schaap goes on, "The black athlete is in a black mood. He has found the theory that equality can be won on the playing field is only a myth. Angered and frustrated, swept along in a new and rising tide of racial tension, he is lashing out, staging boycotts and threatening strikes and hinting at even stronger reprisals." Dick Schaap is standing by in New York to answer your questions and share your comments and conversation about the revolt of the black athletes. You may speak to him direct on our national number, which is area code 212-749-3311. And, of course, you're always welcome to call us collect. That's area code 212-749-3311. In the New York area, you may call us at 866-5010. That's local calls only at 866-5010. Later in the show, we'll have a special call-in guest, former Olympic star Mr. Jesse Owens. Mr. Schaap, good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Thank you for being with us this evening. In your article, you say that the black athlete's revolt has two major symbols, Muhammad Ali, our guest of last night, and Harry Edwards, our guest this coming Friday night. Why in particular these two men, one a boxer stripped of his title and convicted of draft evasion, the other a sociology professor organizing a black boycott of the Olympics?
Well, I choose them as symbols because they represent extremes, and they both have a tendency to overstate their position. I've met Harry Edwards only briefly. Muhammad Ali, I think I know well. I've known for a long time. But in my brief meetings with Harry Edwards, he impressed me as being very similar to Malcolm X, in that I always felt that Malcolm was perfect at stating the situation. But as to coming up with a good solution, Malcolm didn't have a good solution. Probably no one had a good solution right then. The espousal of hate, which Malcolm did, and I never felt that he really meant, is the same thing that Harry Edwards does. I believe he overstates his hatred of the white man, and he does it for obvious effect and with obvious purpose behind it. On the other side, you have Muhammad Ali talking about total separation from the white man, which I don't think he believes either.
Well, you state that these men are overstating their cases, or perhaps in Mr. Edwards' case, that he's overstating it. Let's talk about what is the case.
Well, the case is those three little vignettes which you read at the beginning. There's no question that the situation as it is now, there is prejudice, there is bigotry in sports, just as there is in most segments of American life. I can't think of an immediate exception. The black athlete is not treated equally, except between the starting line and the finish line of a 100-yard dash, and similar situations. it's like everything else, you can say it's getting better, and we can all bow towards gradualism. But it's a bad situation. It is not a totally hellish situation, but it may be close to it. But Harry Edwards states it beyond that point, to the point where he talks about blowing up stadiums, and he talks to the point which other black nationalists have made of saying, well, I'd rather vote for George Wallace or for James Eastland because at least they're honest about how they feel. To me, that's overstating.
May we talk for a minute about some of the behind-the-scenes activities that perhaps the average fan is not aware of? Let's talk about housing for a moment. Is there segregation in housing among the white and black athletes?
You're being polite by asking me. Of course you know the answer. There is segregation both within the teams and outside the teams. For instance, Mike Garrett, the halfback from Kansas, had great trouble in finding a place to live in Kansas City, in a neighborhood where he wanted to live. Within the professional teams themselves, there has been a tradition of segregation, black rooming with blacks, whites rooming with whites, even to the extent where if after roommates were chosen, there was a white man and a black man left over, they would each be given a single room, which costs money, and professional teams don't like to spend money on anything. The situation here, too, is improving slightly. Jerry Kramer of the Green Bay Packers, who is a white guard from Idaho, is rooming this year with Willie Davis, who is a black end from Chicago. This is the first case in the Green Bay Packers where white and black have roomed together, and these two men are both veterans, both stars. But not only are they rooming together, but the general manager, Vince Lombardi, has put in the policy this year that all rookies are being roomed on an alphabetical basis. And if it turns out that all the white players' names happen to begin with A and all the black players' names happen to begin with Z, then it will still have segregation, but I don't think it's turning out that way. The Los Angeles Lakers are another example of a team that does room white and black together. But it's bad in that we can even point to specific examples. Obviously, the ideal would be to have it everywhere and not have to talk about it.
Many black people who are football fans, or professional football fans, we talk in the parlor for those houses where there's still parlors, or the living rooms, often wonder, is there a possibility that whites might accept a full-fledged professional black quarterback?
I think they will. I think it's inevitable. It's got to happen in the next two or three years. I don't remember the names of the young men, but I understand that there's a young man at Grambling, and there's one at another college. I forget whether it's Florida State or Tennessee A&I, but there are two young quarterbacks at those colleges who have been groomed to become professional quarterbacks, and who, from what I've heard, have the ability, and they're going to make it. There's the case this year of Eldridge Dickey, who was a fine quarterback for Tennessee A&I the past few years. In fact, when Dickey was a sophomore 3 years ago, he said that he was going to play professional quarterback and he would not consider playing any other position, and that if he were asked to play any other position, he wouldn't. But now he is playing flanker or end for the Oakland Raiders, and he's also working out as a quarterback. Again, this is secondhand because I haven't seen him play, but from what I've heard, he's a good quarterback, but he's not a superstar quarterback. And this is the thing which often happens with black quarterbacks from black colleges. He's a tremendously talented athlete, so that he's going to be more quickly valuable to the team playing a position that's less difficult to adjust to. Again, I'm spouting on like Muhammad Ali, but to go back to the beginning, it all begins in high school or even sooner, which is where the prejudice begins against the black quarterback. I think that professional athletes have more tolerance than, say, a high school athlete or the next level up. I think you find the greatest degree of acceptance in the professional sports where more of the men are college graduates, and you find less of it in baseball, for instance, where there are fewer college graduates.
If we could measure the degree of prejudice among the various members of the sports establishment, would you say there is more on the part of the participating players or more on the parts of management?
Well, as for strong, ignorant sort of bias, I would say that exists more. more on the part of certain players, certainly not all players, but for calculating bias or economic bias, that's on the part of the management. You won't too often meet the owner of a professional team who is an out-and-out bigot who will use derogatory terms and say things like that. He'll just hurt the fellow financially. It's a different kind of prejudice, a more subtle and perhaps, depending on the point of view, a more invidious prejudice.
There's been a great deal of discussion and quite a bit of writing about the drafting, or I shouldn't say the drafting, but the selecting of black athletes who attend many of the major colleges across the country. And after visiting the colleges or after enrolling in the colleges, they found out that many of the promises that were made were not kept. Now, how does the disappointment or the breakdown of these promises compare to that which happens with the white players?
Again, I think it's certainly a much stronger disappointment. There's also a special factor involved that many of the best black athletes who are recruited out of the South by northern colleges, for instance, Bubba Smith, who came out of Beaumont, Texas, he had never been north really in his life when he went to Michigan State. And he had a false idea of what it was going to be like in the North. He had heard enough Northern propaganda, I suppose, to expect a utopia. And he found out that he had problems finding housing in East Lansing, Michigan, and he had problems in adjusting fully to the social life on the campus. And so the disappointment was heightened by the fact that he expected so much. The idea of the athlete in general being let down by what he finds in college is true, too. The black athlete, too often, perhaps coming out of a high school that doesn't have the same educational facilities as a white high school or a white prep school or something like that, is almost treated as a property. It's that you're coming to college to play football, now take basket weaving and take a good course in underwater biology. You can look through a glass-bottom boat or something like that, and don't worry about any of those hard subjects like chemistry. And maybe at the beginning this sounds good to him. Great, I won't have to think and I can play football. But just by the exposure to college, he begins to realize that he does want an education. And this is where a great deal of the resentment today springs from.
Tonight we are continuing with part two of The Black Athlete in America. And our guest tonight is Mr. Dick Sharp, who wrote a most interesting and most provocative article in Look magazine. And we'll begin taking some of our calls. And our telephone number, our national telephone, was area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. Our local telephone number is 866-5010. Mr. Sharp, you'll take our first call from Philadelphia. Mr. Tatum is hearing night call over WHAT. Your question, Mr. Tatum.
My name is Tatum, and I'm listed in the book in Philadelphia. My reason for calling actually was because I was in New York last night on vacation, or for the last few days, and I happened to hear Mr. Del Shields and Muhammad Ali. And I got the impression that Mr. Shields was transplanted from Philadelphia. So the gentleman who answered the phone confirmed that. But as far as the black athlete and all that jazz, I'm perfectly in favor of the revolution. I mean, the revolt and all that sort of thing. As far as I would like to ask Mr. Sharp,
yes,
if he is familiar with the Esquire article. I'm trying to remember. I'm 51 years old, and I'm born and raised in Pennsylvania. I'm trying to remember the year. And Esquire had an article around 1938, and it was called "May the Best White Man Win." It was the forerunner of these articles that he's writing on the black athlete and the things that they had to do and put up with in order to make it.
Right. Well, at the time, I was 3 years old, so I don't remember it too clearly.
Good.
But I presume that had something to do with a search for the white hope to find you.
It does that, and I hope you will look it up. It was that I remember perfectly the name of the article. The name of the article was "May the Best White Man Win."
It's a good sarcastic line.
Believe me, and you should read it. Now, as far as the black athletes is concerned, I don't believe in threats. Mr. Edwards is probably a very good man, and he's a sincere man. I don't think you should threaten the black athlete or any athlete. I don't believe in threats. I don't think that we are in a position to threaten anybody. I respect Mr. Owens, you know, for his achievements, and I also respect Mr. Walcott for his achievements. But these people seem to be a little more or less apologetic. I don't want to use the word Uncle Tom, but I believe that Mr. Edwards would have a very good point, and that goes for Thomas and all of those other athletes, if they would go through with the Olympics and merely refuse to accept the medals. That's as simple as that. I believe in militancy, but I don't believe in threatening people. I don't believe that we so far have the wherewithal to threaten anybody. And as far as beating, you know, like the things that are going on in some of the cities where we pull white people out of cars, this is a reversal of what they've been doing to us. But, you know, like they can reverse the charges and beat us at it. I wish that they would stop all of this jazz. But I do believe in
Mr. Tatum, I'd like to offer this. Dr. Harry Edwards will be our guest on Friday.
Good.
And you'll have a chance to talk with him directly.
Good.
Look,
tell him what I said and give him my phone number, because I told the man who answered the phone that Bart Tatum's name is listed in the book.
All right, sir.
I respect Mr. Edwards, but I just don't. And whether or not that Mr. Edwards and his committee has threatened anybody, I don't know. I'm a truck driver with an eighth-grade education, so naturally I'm not in them kind of circles. But I'm hoping that Mr. Edwards hasn't threatened any black athlete with retaliation or threatened.
No, there hasn't been any threats, but my suggestion, sir, is that you are free to call us on Friday from wherever you are in the country.
Thank you.
And you call us, and you'll have a chance to talk to Dr. Edwards
Thank
directly.
You.
Thank you so much for calling.
To look up that article.
All right, sir.
The name of the article I remember clearly was May the Best White Man Win, and it was in Esquire magazine in the late 30s, around 1937 or 38.
Right. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you for calling. This is Night Call in New York. We'll continue with more calls from our Night Call listeners to Mr. Dick Sharp right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dick Sharp after station identification. Next week on Night Call, two Catholic priests, two black artists, a corporation president, and a presidential candidate. This new nationwide call-in show on vital issues continues to bring you the experts with the answers to your direct questions. Monday, Father Bernard Herring, an advisor in moral theology to the late Pope John on how Catholics and the rest of us should interpret the encyclical on birth control. Tuesday, Robert Hooks and Douglas Turner Ward of the Negro Ensemble Theater. Wednesday, Democratic Senator, presidential candidate Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota. Thursday, Westinghouse Broadcasting President Don McGannon on equal opportunity employment. And Friday, Father Santon Kilbride, a Biafran missionary, tells it like it is in the African country where the children are literally being starved to death. All this next week on Night Call. Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010. To sports writer Dick Sharp about American sports and black athletes. Again, Del Shields.
And we're back with our guest, Dick Sharp, who's calling in from New York, and to Mr. Tatum, who called in from Philadelphia, and he wanted to know if I was a transplant in Philadelphia. I don't know. I'm still living in Philadelphia as well as New York. But we're so happy that you did call. Dick, let's talk for a moment, or Mr. Sharp, rather, forgive me. Let's talk for a moment about the basic reasons for the revolt of the black athletes. What is it that the athletes are actually looking for, asking for? What are they seeking?
Well, they're seeking many things. I sort of summed it up at the end of my article by saying I think that equality with dignity. But this goes back to everything, what we talked about, of taking the proper academic courses in college, getting a fair shake on every team, getting an equal opportunity to play, getting equal pay for performance in the professional ranks. getting an equal chance at endorsements and at commercials and at the fringe benefits, having the opportunity to coach and to manage and to scout after a playing career is finished. In other words, just getting the normal treatment that an athlete gets, which isn't always good for the white athlete either, but he just wants to be treated the same way.
Well, there are many whites who have raised this particular proposal or proposition. They've said that sports has been very good to the Negro athlete or to the black athlete, so why are they complaining? They're making a lot of money. They're a lot better off than most of their black people, so why should they complain?
Well, because they've surrendered some dignity for this, and they've become aware of it lately. I think it's sort of curious and interesting that the athlete today, the black athlete, is following the rest of the black people. In the past, he's been sort of a leader, just as the black entertainer has been a leader and been an example and been something to point out. Now, actually, the revolt of the black athlete is coming after the revolt of the black student, the revolt of the black ghetto dweller. He's following. He does command a great deal of publicity because of whatever athletic prominence he may have. But still, he's following. He's trying to catch up with what the kids were doing in Nashville and what the kids were doing in Montgomery.
We talked briefly in the first segment about the segregation in housing, the fact that black athletes are forced to live together as opposed to living with white athletes. Let's talk for a little bit more about the breakdown. Now, according to an article, I think, in Sports Illustrated, they pointed out that 13 of 207 pitchers on Major League rosters this summer are Negroes. Are we to interpret this as meaning that Negro pitchers or black pitchers are not particularly welcomed in baseball?
Yeah, I have trouble figuring that out. I've noticed that I didn't have the exact figures, but like in the National League last year, of the top 10 batters, nine were black or nine were Negroes. And of the top 10 pitches, I think like only one or two, Bob Gibson and maybe one other, I can't remember. And I don't quite know why this is. I can't think of any logical reason for it. Certainly the fact that when the first black pitchers players were being allowed into baseball after all the years of Jim Crow, there seemed to be as many pitchers as any other kind of ball player. Don Newcomb was one of the early ones. Dan Bankhead was an early pitcher for the Dodgers right after Jackie Robinson came up. I see no logic behind it. Maybe somebody would say that pitching requires a great deal of thinking, and therefore the black man is not able to be a pitcher, which is the same sort of racist myth which is used against the quarterback. I think they're looking for pitchers just as much as they're looking for hitters, and I don't know any good explanation.
Well, additional figures were carried over in the NFL. Again, referring to the article, they stated that 32 offensive guards in the starting lineups of the NFL teams, 29 were white. I didn't know that the center was considered a coveted position.
Yeah, well, you know, they have a lot of hand contact between the quarterback and the center, and they probably don't want to have any miscegenation in there. But again, I can't see any logical reason for it. Probably if you take the number of defensive tackles and defensive ends, then you get a predominance of black players when you think of the Deacon Jones and Willie Davis and Roosevelt Greer and players like that. There was a thing a few years ago where some Southern ball players, I shouldn't really say that because it's not only Southerners who have a copyright on prejudice, but some ball players I knew who were prejudiced would always point to the fact that there was no Negro linebacker, and they said that's the position that really requires guts and no Negro measures up to it. But now Dave Robinson of the Green Bay Packers is probably the best, or at least one of the two or three best linebackers in professional football, so that myth has fallen by the wayside. I think in football, there were many myths a few years ago about weakness of black athletes folding under pressure, and that the Green Bay Packers all by themselves have helped to disprove this. They're the greatest team in the history of football, and 8 of their 22 regulars last year were black, and it didn't seem to hurt anybody very much, except the opposition.
American sports and the black athletes. Our discussion tonight, our guest calling in from New York, Mr. Dick Sharp of Look Magazine, who wrote the article that we're discussing tonight. And we have standing by from Nashville, Tennessee, hearing Night Call over WVOL, Mr. Harold Hunter, who is a basketball coach at one of the great schools, Tennessee State, and also the school, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Mr. Ralph Boston graduated from. Mr. Hunter, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
How do you do?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. I was sitting here, and I heard you on the air, and thought I'd give you a call because I'd been trying to get in touch with Sports Illustrated since about the 8th of June, and I haven't had any success in speaking with the writer of those articles, which Sports Illustrated has been publishing. So I thought this might be a good chance to talk with him.
I want you to know I had the same problem in reverse. I kept trying to phone your football coach.
Is that right?
And I never called back. I wanted to ask him a little bit more about Eldridge Dickey. Of course, I wanted to reach Eldridge Dickey also.
I see. My question to Dick, and which I was trying to get in touch with him about, was the my dismissal here as coach. When I returned from the European tour as head coach for the United States Olympic basketball team, I wanted to ask Sports Illustrated, since they were making a great revelation of the inequities which Negro and black athletes have suffered at the hands of the so-called white oppressors, what would be Sports Illustrated's interest in learning of some of these inequities which are suffered by black athletes at the hands of black administrators?
I think it's a pretty good story. My immediate reaction, it reminds me of the students in Invisible Man and the treatment they got from the president of a black college.
Well,
Mr. Hunter, for those of us who might not be familiar with the case, could you fill us in? Are you able to do that?
Sure.
I understand you are a basketball coach now at Tennessee A&I?
No, I was just replaced while I was on the trip for the AAU committee and the United States Olympic Basketball Committee. I was replaced. The school hired another man and had him working by the time I got back. And this has all come about because since 1961, I have chosen to oppose the administration at this school because they wanted me to treat players under my supervision unfairly, or simply because I spoke out against their treating these fellows unfairly. And, of course, one thing has led to another, and finally, when I was gone out of the country on a mission for the United States, I was fired for trumped-up charges, which were supported all the way down the line by the state administration. The very simple charge of saying that I was absent from class without permission, and neither the dean of the faculty who carried the charges to the commissioner of the State Board of Education, nor the commissioner of the State Board of Education took it upon themselves to simply make a phone call to the head of the department to ask if I had permission to be absent. And so for this reason, I was replaced. And as I said, another fellow was hired, and his assistant coach were working when I got back from the European trip. And all of this has been brought about as a result of my opposing this university's plans of suppression and persecution against basketball players under my supervision. And I was just wondering if, since we're going to divulge all of the sins which have been carried out against black athletes by white universities, I'm wondering if we as black people wouldn't also like to know the truth about some of our black administrators' treatment of black athletes in their schools.
How long had you been basketball coach, sir?
This is my ninth year.
Who are some of the people who have gone into the pros from your school?
Well, the first now the head coach at Cleveland State. And under him, I saw Dick Barnett, John Barnhill, Ben Worley go into the pros. Under me, Porter Merriweather went in. Ben Worley also played under me, went to the Syracuse Nets. This past season in the ABA, Bobby Edmonds, Willie Porter, Bill Bradley played with the Louisville team. And I had three fellows to be drafted in both leagues this year from the team. One is 6'9", Edward Johnson, who's already signed with the L.A. Stars. Dwight Waller, who has a contract in his pocket, and he's supposed to return to Atlanta Hawks camp next month.
Mr. Hunter, I'm going to ask you to hold. We're going to have to go for station identification. We'll be coming right back, and if you'll be kind enough to hold on, I think we'll get an answer from Mr. Shop.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dick Schaap after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, our week-long series on American sports and black athletes continues with player coach Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics talking about the black boss and the white player. Thursday night, Frank Robinson of the Baltimore Orioles. He was the American League's most valuable player in 1966, but Robinson says that title and the other two legs of the Triple Crown he won that year weren't all that valuable to him. But there's still a lot of financial segregation at the top of the major leagues, and even more important from a money standpoint, there's even more of it in the very lucrative field of endorsing products. Friday night, Harry Edwards tells why he's trying to organize a black boycott of the 1968 Olympics and just what success he's having so far. Tomorrow night, continue our week-long special series, American Sports and Black Athletes, with Bill Russell on the Black Boss and the White Player on Night Call. Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010 to sports writer Dick Schaap about American sports and black athletes. Again, Del Shields.
And welcome to the Night Call stations who always join us for the second half hour. Our guest calling in from New York, Mr. Dick Schaap, who wrote a most provocative and interesting article in Look magazine called The Revolt of the Black Athletes. And also calling in from Nashville, Tennessee, Mr. Harold Hunter, who's on the line, the just recently dismissed basketball coach at Tennessee A&I, and he was addressing his question to Mr. Schaap in terms of the need to focus attention on his particular case, as well as some of the inequities that are being suffered by black athletes at the hands of black administrators. Mr. Hunter?
Yes, I'm here.
We're going to ask Mr. Schaap if he'd like to respond, and perhaps we'll find out if he feels that your case warrants some kind of exposure. Mr. Schaap?
I certainly don't have any easy answer, but it seems to me that it is something that Sports Illustrated would be interested in, and I'm surprised that you haven't been able to get through to Jack Olson or to someone there at Sports Illustrated who's involved in this. I've been identified as a member of the of Look magazine. I'm not. I'm a freelance writer, and I did this article for them. So I have no publication except my typewriter. But Sports Illustrated, which does try to cover the whole spectrum of sports activity, would seem a very logical place to examine this. It does certainly sound a little strange. I'd be interested in knowing more about the case.
Well, I might just say here, not to break my arm, pat myself on the back, that in the 9 years here, I don't think
Mr. Hunter? We may have lost Mr. Hunter temporarily. We know he'll be coming back. Mr. Schaap?
I think those administrators just got through again.
All right, we'll see if we can get Mr. Hunter back. In the meantime, we'll take our next call from Fort Worth, Texas. Mr. Ballard is hearing Night Call over KNOK. Your question, Mr. Ballard.
Yes. I was about the question you had a few minutes ago on linebacker, Negro linebacker position.
Right.
Right. Okay. You were concerned about that. How long do you think we'll be before we'll ever have a Negro quarterback in the NFL?
Well, we talked about this a little bit earlier, and I really think it'll be within the next 2 or 3 years. I think so. From what I hear about the boys in college now, it will be within a few years.
They really feel that way.
I do. I don't see any reason why not. They just, you know, they need good quarterbacks so desperately that I don't care if they're pink or green. Somebody's going to use them.
Right. Okay.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
This is Night Call in New York, area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. That's our national telephone number, and of course you may feel free to call us collect. And our local telephone number is 866-5010. In New York, 866-5010. Mr. Sharp, what has been the response to Bill Russell being the first black coach of a professional basketball team?
I think the response has generally been good. I haven't seen much overt criticism. I think nobody questions his ability, both as a player and as a coach. It's an incredibly difficult job for any man to do both at once, yet he seems to have succeeded quite well at it. No one denies his knowledge. I think he's been accepted very quickly. I don't think he's had any trouble that I've heard of with white players or with black players. I just think it's worked fine. It's proven again that the feeling that a white player won't listen to a black coach is ridiculous as long as he respects the man.
Do you foresee in the immediate future any other black coach of a basketball team?
I'm not as close to the basketball picture as I might be, so I really don't know enough about it. I don't know among the players, white or black, who are best qualified to be coaches. I would imagine, though, somebody like Casey Jones, who's now coaching in college, whether it's Brandeis or some college, it certainly has the ability and the intelligence to be a professional coach.
This is Night Call in New York, American Sports and the Black Athletes, area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. And we were disconnected before with Mr. Harold Hunter. He's back on the line, and we'll give him just a few more moments. Mr. Hunter?
Yes?
Sorry we were disconnected, sir.
Well, I am too. I thought maybe some shenanigans had gone on at this end.
Well, Mr. Sharp has already stated that he felt that Sports Illustrated should be interested in your story. But Mr. Sharp, as a freelance writer and one who has written on the subject of sports, what other steps would you suggest for Mr. Hunter to take?
Well, I would suggest, one, that try to get through to them yourself. And if that proves difficult, I would say have some of those former players do some talking, because the ones you mentioned, there's some pretty good names there and people who have perhaps better access than you have to national medium, someone like Dick Barnett or Barnhill or someone like that. It seems to me that there should be a pretty interesting story there, one way or the other. I can't help repeating what I said before, though. It keeps reminding me of the chapter in Ralph Ellison's book, Invisible Man, where the real oppressor of the black student in the black college was the black administrator.
This is certainly a fact here. And the local paper is trying to give some ventilation to the problem, but we're having a real big problem here, and anyone on this faculty who has competencies off the faculty, in other words, they can go beyond this area and perform a job well, and who have spoken out against these suppressive tactics, have been demoted, set aside, or outright fired in a purge campaign, which has been carried on by a group of little short-sighted men here.
Can I just ask for a little sharper definition? I mean, it was the feeling that you were too militant. Was that the complaint?
That was a complaint,
yeah.
Plus the fact that I just defied their little dictatorial statements, which were based on regulations and rules, which they thought up strictly for me. And they applied only to the basketball team.
Right.
I had charge these people to the state authorities here for violations of rules, regulations, and just general practices, which were far more serious than anything they charged me for. And add to the sin of it all, I can prove, I feel very certain that I can prove the charges I made against them. And yet in a personal confrontation with the two gentlemen who are serving in the absence of the president here, they couldn't even tell me what was on the letter that they signed which fired me.
How about John Siegenthaler, the editor of the Nashville Tennessean? He's always impressed me as a pretty square guy.
Well, he is, and his paper is the one that is giving some voice to it.
Mm-hmm. I meant square in the good sense, yeah.
Well, in actuality, Mr. Hunter?
Yes.
Yes, in actuality, what we're discussing with you is the fact that actually it's a local situation, really, your fight against the local administration of the Tennessee University, or the Tennessee A&I University. Am I right in that?
Well, I guess that's it in a nutshell.
Right. Well, as Mr. Sharp has said, perhaps if you would get in touch with some of your former players and try to get some rallying support from them, and then again contact Sports Illustrated, either with a night letter telegram or perhaps a good letter to them, perhaps you might be able to get some response. And I'm certain that we are heard tonight over 60 stations, and you have certainly made many of us aware of what the problem is, and we should be able to get some action for you.
Who would be the number one person at Sports Illustrated to contact?
I guess Jack Olson, who wrote the series on the black athlete.
Yes, I called him. I never could get him.
Well, then write to Andrew Crichton, C-R-I-C-H-T-O-N. He answers mail, I know that.
I see. Spell that again for me.
C-R-I-C-H-T-O-N.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for calling, sir. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, area code 212-749-3311. That's our national telephone number. And remember, you may call us a collect. And I wanted to mention that we had placed the call into Mr. Jesse Owens, who was going to be our special call-in guest tonight for the second half. We have not as yet heard from him, and our producers are busily trying to make contact with him. We'll take our next call from Philadelphia, Mr. Randolph, who I understand has qualified for the Olympic team for the 100-meter competition. He's listening to Night Call over WHAT in Philadelphia. Mr. Randolph?
Yes, good evening.
Welcome, sir.
I've qualified in the 100 meters. I placed sixth in Los Angeles and fifth in the 200 meters. And also with me is Larry James from Villanova, known as the Mighty Burner, who placed fourth in the 400 meters. We live together in Philadelphia, and we run for a club here. And we've been listening to WHAT. I wanted to make a comment first on Harry Edwards. Some people have alleged that he threatened some of the athletes concerning the boycott. If they didn't seem like they were for it, then he was threatening them. Well, we had a series of meetings in Los Angeles. We had three track meets out there, the National Collegiate Meet in Berkeley, the AAU meet in Sacramento, and then the Olympic Trials in Los Angeles over three weekends. And we had about five meetings at these three places. And all of the athletes were there. At all the meetings, and to my knowledge, no one, including myself, or any other black athlete with I'm familiar with, was threatened. We talked about these things. Some people were for them, some were against. We've reached a decision as to what our course of action would be, and everyone, unless there was a meeting held that I don't know about, everyone agreed that the course of action that we agreed on was unanimous, and I mean all the black athletes that made the Olympic team in track and field agreed on this. They were all there present at the last meeting in Los Angeles, and the decision is secret as of this time. We can't reveal what it is, but we've all been sworn to secrecy. I've seen some statements in the paper. Some have been correct, and some have been just speculation.
Has Lee Evans been correct? That's not fair.
Interview from... And partly, but I can't really comment or give a direct thing on it. Now, I write a column for my school newspaper. I go to Western Michigan University. I was writing a series of articles on the boycott, giving them week-to-week developments. I had to scrape that series because I couldn't say anything else. I was sworn to secrecy.
Yeah, I just want to make it clear that I didn't say that he threatened anyone. I think what Harry Edwards has done is he has implicitly threatened not current athletes, but people like Joe Lewis, Jesse Owens, current athlete, Willie.
Willie Mays by putting him, putting them up on his bulletin board as what he calls the nigger of the week. And he implies that they are no better than the worst white man. I disagree with him in these implications.
The thinking of, if I can speak for the attitude of the athletes who were present at this meeting, they ran from all spectrums, from militant to Uncle Tom's, if you will. But the general feeling was that people like Joe Louis and Jesse Owens, while they were great athletes, they were really in a good position to do something other than be a good athlete. Because the feeling seems to be, in my opinion, that here we are athletes and we've reached the pinnacle, at least in our profession that we're in right now, track and field. So it's up to us to bring about any changes that need to be brought about. For instance, at my school, if I'm the top athlete in track and field, who would be better in a better position to approach the administration about some needed changes, which we did at Western. And I felt like I had to be the spokesman because they wouldn't listen to a fifth-string halfback or track man that can't break 10 seconds. But since I'm their top track man, I know they would feel that they would have to listen to me.
Yes,
of course, I command that attention. Joe Louis didn't do this in his time, even though it would have been very radical in his time.
But not only didn't he do it, no one else was doing it. And those kids down in the South who were staging the sit-ins and so on, they weren't athletes. They were just kids, and it wasn't until they did it that the athletes then came in.
Mr. Randolph and Mr. Sharp, if you'll hold for just a moment, sure. We're going to go off for station identification. We'll be coming right back. And Mr. Randolph, we would like to ask you when we come back just what is it that you want as a black athlete in America. So we'll be coming right back. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Dick Schaap after station identification. Listen to the voices of Night Call.
We're trying to bring about change in this nation through nonviolent channels. Now, if we cannot do it through nonviolence, there are other forces that are going to lead people down a violent path, and the nation will be destroyed.
Ralph Abernathy on apathy and violence, and a white industrialist says jobs will save us from a racial inferno.
It's better to learn and earn than to burn, baby, burn. Now, these are the changes in attitude that spring from the community as a whole to try to work with these people, not just work on them, and to have industry reach into the area and try to recruit and hire the guy that's qualified and to get the other fellow to take training so he, too, can get a job.
Speak for yourself on Night Call. Speak for yourself. Collect on Night Call. Area code 212-749-3311 or 866-5010. To sports writer Dick Schaap about American sports and black athletes. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Dick Schaap, who is calling in from New York, who wrote the article in Look magazine about black athletes, and also calling in from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, hearing Night Call over WHAT, Mr. Randolph. And Mr. Randolph is qualified for the Olympic team at the 100-meter competition. I wanted to say, Mr. Randolph, are you with us?
Yes, I'm still here.
And Mr. Schaap?
Yes.
Right. I just wanted to say that our producers, in putting together this special series this week, we attempted to contact Mr. Willie Mays, and Mr. Willie Mays refused to come on the show. And Mr. Jesse Owens, who we talked to yesterday, promised that he would call in tonight, and we have been trying to call him, and there's no answer at the number. So I just want to let you know that we tried to get all opinions. Now, Mr. Randolph, what is it that you personally, first, as an athlete, what do you see wrong, first, with the athletic picture here in America as regards to the black man, and then what is it that you want personally?
Well, we're really speaking of two different aspects, the professional or the amateur.
Well, let's take, you're an amateur.
Right.
Well, let's talk about the amateurs.
Well, as it concerns universities, the problems that I've run into personally and from going to track meets nationally and speaking to other black athletes, the general problems seem to be pretty much as outlined in the Sports Illustrated series, that the administrations of the school and the athletic departments of schools, they seem to exploit either very knowingly and intentionally or even unknowingly exploit an athlete for his talents without too much regard for his personal welfare. I've run across an abundance of athletes who have put in their 4 years of eligibility, and they're not qualified to graduate at the time when they should, either because the coach counseled them to not take or avoid hard, difficult courses, and then they find that in their last semester, they've got all the difficult courses waiting for them when they should have been spacing them out. I've ran into the same problem myself at Western, but fortunately for me, I rejected the coach's counsel and planned my own program. That plus a lack of black people in the at athletic departments. At first, they tried to tell me at Western that no black people have applied for these positions. Like, in the whole United States, there's not one black coach that they could have found. But then it came to my knowledge that they go out, when they find a vacancy in their department, they go out and look for a man. They've just never looked for a black man. Maybe they didn't especially turn any down, but they've never looked for any. So, but with enough pressure from black athletes, we changed the situation. They couldn't do with us like they did with Texas of El Paso because they, in a sense, they needed us. It was sort of a mutual need sort of situation.
Well, in terms of arranging your schedule, you said you rejected the coach's counseling and you had to kind of work out your own thing. Isn't this possible with other athletes?
Yes, it is, but there were probably some athletes that were not really fully trained. Now, we're speaking of black athletes who are not, most black people, period, whether athlete or not, are not really prepared to go to college, even when they're not athletes. It's because of the inferior schools that they are forced to attend in the United States. They're not prepared for college work. So the average black person going into college is behind when he gets there.
Have you found this, Mr. Shupp?
Yes, I think what he's saying is absolutely true, and that he is an exception in that he was able to fight it right from the beginning. Too many black athletes have found themselves in this position of finishing their 4 years of eligibility and then finding out they have to take all the real courses.
Right, and I might add that even if you find an athlete that can run 109.3, the academic requirements seem to be lowered a little. Now, as an example, I dropped out of high school after 1 year and went into the Army, and I was in Vietnam. But before I going to Vietnam, I had a track meet in Europe, and I met the coach from the school I attend now. He offered me a scholarship. I was admitted to the school on the strength of running 9.2 for 100 yards in South America and 1 year of high school. I didn't have any problem with school academically. My problem was motivational. I just didn't see the purpose of education until later on, but it might not have worked out that way. Suppose I just wasn't college material. They took me for the 9.2, not for the 1 year of high school. And fortunately, it worked out okay in my case, but in a lot of cases, it doesn't.
Mr. Randolph, we want to thank you for calling in, and on Friday night, Dr. Edwards will be our guest, and I certainly hope you'll come back and favor us with another call.
I certainly will.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
This is NyQuil in New York. Our guest is Mr. Dick Shupp, who wrote a provocative article in Look magazine called The Revolt of the Black Athletes. And all of this week, we are discussing American sports and the black athletes. We have standing by, or have with us standing by, rather, in Salisbury, North Carolina, Mr. Marshall, who I understand is a football coach at Livingston College, who is hearing NyQuil over WAAFM in Winston-Salem. Mr. Marshall?
Yep.
How are you, sir?
Fine. How are you, Mr. Steele?
Fine, thank you. How's the coach doing this evening?
Oh, boy, it's getting time to get those horses ready. Getting ready to get those horses ready for this fall season.
Well, how do you feel about the black athletes?
Well, I'd like to congratulate, I guess, Mr. Schatz and Mr. Olson from Sports Illustrated, both, having gone to a Midwestern school for graduate work. I know many of the things that they wrote are kind of right. And, of course, it's just, I guess it took a little courage and conviction, I guess, to get those things out.
It takes a lot more courage to be a black athlete than
you
get away.
I'm sure of that. I'm sure of that. That's one of the reasons I decided to call, really. I want to ask Mr. Schatz, really, since he has written that article, I know he's had some contact with NFL clubs or with someone in some of the NFL clubs, and he said that he expected a Negro quarterback or a black quarterback to be in 2 or 3 years away. Why so
because it takes a couple of years to develop a quarterback. There are very few pros. Joe Namath's the only one I can think of who made it in the first year. And I think there'll be some coming out of college this year. And then it'll take a couple of years on the bench. It does for everybody. It did for Johnny Unitas. It did for Bart Starr.
Oh, I understand that. I understand that very well.
But I think that the acceptance is there now, and I think that if Eldridge Dickey suddenly proves that he's a far better quarterback than he is a flanker, that Oakland would use him as a quarterback. I don't think they have any prejudice as far as that's concerned, except against losing.
Mm-hmm. Coach Marshall?
Yeah.
We have kind of been brainwashed by the networks with the abundance of television football games throughout the season. Mm-hmm. And I suppose we all have become kind of armchair critics, per se. But what is the special ingredient that is needed to be a quarterback? Or what is so special that they just won't open up to have a black man to be quarterback?
My personal feeling, Mr. Shields, is that you've got to have a fellow who can really take charge. He's got to be a guy that, he doesn't have to be the smartest guy in the world, but he's got to be a guy that other players look up to. And if he's not one of those, he's got to be a real leader. Plus, he's got to have ability. There's no doubt that he has to have ability. But he's got to have that real take-charge drive.
He doesn't have to be loud, though. I mean, like Bart Starr is very quiet.
Right. Well, no, I don't mean talking all the time.
Yeah.
It's not that he doesn't have to be a chatter guy. He doesn't have to be a Billy Martin of any kind, but he's really got to be a guy with who can go out and show guys. Now, the reason I called, really, was because 2 years ago, we had the nation's leading passer at our school. A kid who was 6'2", about 195 pounds, who, when I say led the nation, I'm talking about big schools, small schools, any kind of school you can think of.
Mm-hmm.
He was a kid who threw something like 338 passes. In 1 year, he completed 176. He had 10 intercepted. He threw 29 touchdown passes for better than 2,500 yards. And you think anybody talked with him? Not a chance. He finally wound up going to Canada, but our problem was they wanted him to play defense too. And this is the thing that usually happens with a kid like Dickey.
Yeah.
He goes out to Oakland and want to make a flanker out of him because he can run fast.
Sure, Willie Wood, same thing.
Willie Wood, same thing. Well, our kids wasn't fast. And I told him at the beginning that there was no place that he could play with quarterback. But now, if you look at our film, and we don't get the best film in the world, but you look at it and you look at his record, he must have had something on the ball. Any kid that can throw 29 touchdown passes in a year must have something on the ball. Any kid who only throws 10 interceptions in a year must have something on the ball.
Coach Marshall, I'm sorry. Coach Marshall, I'm sorry the time has run out on us, but I want to thank you so much for calling, and mm-hmm. good luck to you at Livingston.
Oh, we need it. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, sir.
All right.
Mr. Sharp, I want to thank you for being our guest tonight on Night Call, and I hope the revolt of the black athletes will lead to positive action. Tomorrow night, it will be Bill Russell. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the new nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station. American Sports and Black Athletes, Part 3. Player coach Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics on The Black Boss and the White Player. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.